He rubbed his bare forearms as he tried to guess about her. What would she be up to? "Are you associated with the Animal Relief League, or one of those defiant little humanitarian organizations?" "I never use the words humanist or humanitarian, as it seems to me that to be human is to be capable of the most heinous crimes in nature."
"You're evading again."
"That's my job," she said. "There, that's a clue for you, dear Fiero. Amplify." "I went underground," she said softly, "and I am still underground. You're the first one to crack my anonymity since I said goodbye to Glinda 5 years ago. So you now know why I can't say any more, or why you can't see me again. For all I know, you will turn me into the Gale Force."
"Ha! Those martinets? You think very little of me if you think I..."
"How do I know? How could I know?" She twisted her fingers together, a puzzle of green sticks. "They march in those boots all over the poor and the weak. They terrify households at 3 in the morning and drag away dissenters and break up printing presses with their axes and hold mock trials for treason at midnight and executions at dawn. They rake over every quarter of this beautiful false city. They harvest a crop of victims on a monthly basis. It's government by terror. They could be massing on the street right now. Never having yet followed me, they may have followed you."
"You're not as hard to follow as you think," he told her. "You're good, but not that good. I could teach you a few things."
"I bet you could," she said. "But you won't, for we won't meet again. It's too dangerous for you as well as for me. That's what I mean when I say I loved you all too much to keep in touch. Do you think the Gale Force is above torturing friends and family to get at sensitive information? You've got a wife and children, and I'm merely an old college friend you ran into once. Clever you to have followed me. Never again, do you hear? I will move if I find you're trailing me. I can pick up right now and be away in 30 seconds. It's my training."
"Don't do this to me," he said.
"We're old friends," she said, "but we're not even especially good friends. Don't turn this into a sentimental rendezvous. It's nice to see you, but I don't ever want to see you again. Take care of yourself and beware high connections with bastards, because when the revolution comes, there won't be mercy for toadying ass-lickers."
"At, what, 23 years old, you're playing the Lady Rebel?" he said. "It's not becoming."
"It's unbecoming," she agreed. "A perfect word for my new life. Unbecoming. I, who have always been unbecoming, am becoming un. Though I point out you are the same age as I, and prancing about as a prince. But have you eaten enough? We have to say goodbye now."
"We don't," he said firmly.
He wanted to take her hands in his. He didn't remember that he'd ever touched her before. He corrected himself. He knew he never had. It was almost as if she could read his mind. "You know who you are," she said. "But you don't know who I am. You can't. I mean, you can't and you can't. It's not allowed, for one, and you're not capable for the other. Godspeed, if they use that phrase in the Vincas, if it's not a curse. Godspeed, Fiero." She handed him his opera cape and held out her hand to shake his. He grabbed her hand and looked up into her face, which just for a second had fallen open. What he saw there made him chill and hot flash in dizzying simultaneity with the shape and scale of its need. "What do you hear of Bach?" she asked, the next time they met.
"You just won't answer me anything about yourself, will you?" he said. He was lounging with his feet up on her table. "Why did you finally agree to let me come back if you keep yourself locked up like a prisoner?"
I rather liked Bach, that's all," she grinned. "I let you come back so I could pump you for news of him and of the others." He told her what he knew. Bach had married Miss Miller, of all surprising turns. She had been dragged out to Nest Harding's, and she hated it. She kept trying suicide. "His letters sent at Lerninmus every year are hysterical. They annotate her failed attempts at killing herself like a sort of annual family report." "It makes me wonder, in the same circumstances, what my mother must have gone through," said Elphaba. "The privileged childhood in the big home of the Ascendancy, then the rude shock of a hard life out there in nowhere land. In Mama's case, from Colwyn Grounds to Rush Margins, then the Quadling Lowlands. It's actually a penance of the most severe sort."
"Like mother, like daughter," said Fiero. "Haven't you left a certain amount of privilege yourself to live here like a snail, hidden and private?"
"I remember the first time I saw you," she said, shaking drops of vinegar over the roots and vegetables she was preparing for a supper. "It was in that lecture hall of what's-his-name, Dr.—
"Dr. Nicodick," said Fiero. He blushed.
"You had those beautiful markings on your face. I'd never seen such before. Did you plan that entrance to win your way into our hearts?"
"On my honor, could I have done anything else, I would have. I was both mortified and terrified. Do you know, I thought those enchanted antlers were going to kill me. And it was Prancing Crope and Fliberty Tibbet who saved me."
"Crope and Tibbet! Tibbet and Crope! I'd forgotten all about them. How are they?"
"Tibbet was never the same after that escapade at the Philosophy Club. Crope, I think, entered an arts auction house and still flits around with the theatrical set. I see him from time to time at occasions. We don't speak."
"My, you're disapproving," she laughed.
"Of course, being as prurient as the next creature, I always wondered what the Philosophy Club had turned out to be like. You know, in another life, I'd like to see them all again. And Glinda, dear Glinda, and even nasty Averick, what of him?"
"Averick I do speak to. He's most of the year installed in the Margravate, but he has a house in Chiz, and when in the Emerald City we stay at the same club."
"Is he still a smug boor?"
"My, you're disapproving now."
"I suppose I am."
They ate their dinner. Fiero waited for her to ask more about his family, but it was their respective families they were keeping from each other, apparently. His Vincus wife and children, her circle of agitators and insurrectionists. The next time he came, he thought, he must wear a shirt open at the neck, so she could see that the pattern of blue diamonds on his face continued unbroken down his chest, since she seemed to like that.
"Surely you don't spend the entire autumn season in the Emerald City?" she asked one evening, when the cold was drawing in.
"I've sent word to Sarima that business is keeping me here indefinitely. She doesn't care. How could she care? Plucked out of a filthy caravansary and married as a small child to an Arjiki prince? Her family wasn't stupid. She's got food, servants, and the solid stone walls of Kiamo Ko for defense against the other tribes. She's going a little fat after her third child. She doesn't really notice whether I'm home or not. Well, she has five sisters, and they all moved in. I married a harem."
"No!"
Elphaba sounded intrigued and a little embarrassed at the idea. "You're right. No, not really. Sarima has proposed once or twice that her younger sisters could and would happily occupy my energies at night time. Once you pass over the Great Kells, the taboo against such an exercise
isn't as strong as it seems to be in the rest of Oz, so stop looking so shocked.
I can't help it.
Did you do it?
Did I do it?
He was teasing her. Did you sleep with your sisters-in-law?
No, he said. Not out of lofty moral standards, or a lack of interest either. It's just that Sarima is a shrewd wife, and everything in marriage is a campaign. I would have been in her thrall even more than I am.
Such a bad thing?
You're not married, you don't know.
Yes, a bad thing.
I am married, she said, just not to a man.
He raised his eyebrows. She put her hands to her face. He'd never seen her look like that. Her words had shocked herself. She had to turn her head away for an instant, clear her throat, blow her nose.
Oh, damn! Tears! They burn like fire! She cried, suddenly in a fury, and ran for an old blanket to dab her eyes before the salty wetness could run down her cheeks. She stood bent over like an old woman, one arm on the counter, the blanket falling from her face to the floor.
"Elfie! Elfie!" he said, horrified, and lurched after her and put his arms around her. The blanket hung between them, chin to ankles, but seemed about to burst into flame itself, or roses, or a fountain of champagne and incense. Odd how the richest images bloomed in the mind when the body itself was most alert.
"No!" she cried. "No, no, I'm not a harem. I'm not a woman. I'm not a person, no."
But her arms wheeled of their own accord like windmill sails, like those magicked antlers, not to kill him, but to pin him with love, to mount him against the wall. Malky, with a rare display of discretion, climbed to the window-sill and looked away from them. They conducted their love affair in the room above the abandoned corn exchange as the autumn weather came lop-leggedly in from the east. Now a warm day, now a sunny one, now 4 days of cold winds and thin rain. There were long days in a row when they couldn't meet.
"I have business. I have work. Trust me, or I shall disappear on you," she said. "I shall write to Glinda and ask her to share the spell on how to go up in a puff of smoke. I am teasing, but I mean it, Fiyero."
"Fiyero plus Fay," he wrote, in the flour that spilled when she rolled out a pie crust. Fay, she had whispered, as if even to keep it from the cat, was her code name. No one in the cell could know one another's real names. She would not let him see her naked in the light, but since he also was not allowed to visit during the day, this was hardly a problem. She waited for him on the appointed evenings, sitting naked under the blanket, reading essays on political theory or moral philosophy.
"I don't know that I understand them. I read them as poetry," she once admitted. "I like the sound of the words, but I don't ever really expect my slow, slanted impression of the world to change by what I read."
"Is it changing by how you live?" he asked, turning down the light and slipping out of his clothes.
"You think all this is new to me," she said, sighing. "You think I am such a virgin."
"You didn't bleed the first time," he observed. "So what's to think about?"
"I know what you think," she said. "But how experienced are you, Lord Sir Fiyero, Arjiki Prince of Kiamoko, mightiest stalker of the thousand-year grasslands, chiefest chieftain in the great Kells?"
"I am putty in your hands," he said truthfully. "I married a child bride, and to preserve my power I haven't been unfaithful until now." "You are not like her," he said. "You don't feel like her. It doesn't feel the same. You're more secret." "I don't exist," she said. "So you're still not being unfaithful either."
"Let's not be unfaithful right now, then," he said. "I can't wait." Running his hands along her ribs, down the tight plane of her stomach. She always brought his hands to her thin, expressive breasts. She would not be touched below the waist by hands. They moved together, blue diamonds on a green field.
He didn't have enough to do during the days. Being the chieftain of the Arjiki people, he knew it was in their political interest to be tied ineluctably to the commercial hub of the Emerald City. Yet Arjiki business concerns only required Fihiro to show his face at social engagements, in board meetings and financial parlors. The rest of the time he wandered about, seeking frescoes of St. Glinda and other saints. Elphaba Fabula Elphi Fay would never tell him what she had been doing in the chapel of St. Glinda, attached to the Montory in St. Glinda Square. One day he looked up Averick, and they had lunch. Averick suggested a girly show afterward, and Fihiro begged off. Averick was opinionated, cynical, corrupt, and as good-looking as ever. There wasn't much gossip to bring back to Elphaba. The wind tore the leaves from the trees. The gale force continued to frog-march animals and collaborators out of town. Interest rates in the Gillikin banks went soaring up. Good for investors, bad for those who had adjustable rate loans. Foreclosures on a lot of valuable city center properties. Too early, businesses began stringing the green and gold lights of Lurleenmas, trying to woo cautious and depressed citizens into the shops. More than anything else, he wanted to walk the streets of the Emerald City with Elphaba. There was no more beautiful place to be in love, especially at dusk as the shop lights went on, golden against the blue-purple evening sky. He had never been in love before, he now saw. It humbled him. It scared him. He couldn't bear it when their forced absence went 4 or 5 days. "Kisses to Irji, Manak, and Noor," he wrote on the bottom of his weekly letter to Sarima, who couldn't write back because, among other things, she had never learned either alphabet. Somehow her silence seemed a tacit approval of this vow-shattering interlude. He didn't write kisses to her, too. He hoped the chocolates would do. He rolled over, tugging the blanket with him. She tugged it back. The air in the room was so cold it seemed clammy. Malky endured their thrashing legs in order to stay near them, to receive warmth, and to give whatever passes for affection in cats. "My darling Fay," said Fihiro, "you probably know this, and I'm not about to become a co-conspirator at whatever it is you're working for, reducing library fines, or revoking the need for cat collars or whatever, but I do keep my ears open. The Quadlings are under the thumb of the marching militia again. At least, that's what they're saying in the lounge of the club, over newspapers and pipes. Apparently an army division has gone down into Quadling country as far as Coyer, on some sort of a slash-and-burn mission. Your father, your brother, and Nessa Rose, are they still there?" Elphaba didn't answer for a while. She seemed to be working out not only what she wanted to say, but perhaps even what she could remember. Her expression was of puzzlement, even testiness. She said, "We lived in Coyer for a time, when I was about 10. It's a funny little low town built on boggy ground. Half the streets are canals. The roofs are low. The windows are grilled or louvered to provide privacy and ventilation. The air is steamy and the flora excessive. Huge roundels of palmy leaf, almost like shallow quilted pillows, making a sound as they beat against each other in the wind. Tur, 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 tur.
"I don't know that there's much of choir left," said Fiero carefully, "if the gossip I picked up is accurate."
"No, Papa isn't there now, thank whoever, whatever, thank nothing," continued Elphaba, "unless things have changed. The good people of choir weren't very responsive to missionary efforts. They'd invite Papa and me in, serve us little damp cakelets and lukewarm red mint tea. We'd all sit on low, mildewing cushions, scaring geckos and spiders into the deeper shadows. Papa would drone on about the generous nature of the unnamed God, doing his basic xenophiliac slant. He pointed to me as proof. I would grin with horrible sweetness and sing a hymn, the only music Papa approved of. I was miserably shy and ashamed of my color, but Papa had convinced me of the value of this work. Invariably the gentle citizens of choir would capitulate out of hospitality. They'd allow themselves to be led in prayers to the unnamed God, but you couldn't say their hearts were in it. I think I sensed a great deal more dishearteningly than Papa did, how ineffectual we really were.
So where are they now, Papa, Nessa Rose, and the boy, your brother, what's his name?
Shell, that's his name. Well, Papa felt his work was farther south in Quadling country, in the real outback. We had a series of small cramped homes around ovals. The hovels and ovals, we called them. That dreary, beastly countryside, full of a bloody beauty. At his questioning expression, she continued. I mean, 15-20 years ago, Fiero, the Emerald City speculators, discovered the ruby deposits there, first under the Ozma regent, then after the coup under the wizard. Same ugly business practices. Though under the Ozma regent the exploitation did not require murder and brutality. Using elephants, the engineers hauled in gravel, they dammed up springs, they perfected a complicated system of strip mining under 3 feet of brackish groundwater. Papa thought this disarray in their little moist society was a situation ready-made for mission work, and he was right. The Quadlings struggled against the wizard with ill-argued proclamations. They resorted to totems, but their only military weapons were slingshots. So they rallied around my father. He converted them. They went into the struggle with the zeal of the newly chastised. They were dispossessed and disappeared. All with the benefit of Unionist grace.
My, you're bitter.
I was a tool. My dear father used me, and Nessa Rose less so, because of her trouble moving about. He used me as an object lesson. Looking as I did, even singing as I can, they trusted him partly as a response to the freakiness of me. If the unnamed God could love me, how much more responsible it'd be to the unadulterated them?
So, my dear, you don't care where he is or what happens to him now?
How can you say that? She sat up, steaming. I love the mad old tunnel-visioned bastard. He really believed in what he preached. He even thought that a Quadling corpse found floating face up in a brackwater pond, provided it had a tattoo of conversion on it somewhere, was better off than a survivor. He felt he'd written a single ticket to the Otherland assembly of the unnamed God. I think he considered it work well done.
And you don't?
Fiero had a fairly anemic spiritual life. He felt unqualified to voice an opinion about her father's vocation.
Maybe it was work well done,
she said sadly. "How do I know? But not for me. Settlement by settlement we reaped converts. Settlement by settlement the Civil Engineering Corps came in to detonate the village life. There was no outcry throughout Oz proper. Nobody was listening. Who cared about the Quadlings?"
"But what brought him there in the first place?"
"He and Mama had a friend, a Quadling, who died in my family home, a Quadling itinerant, a glassblower." Elphaba frowned and closed her eyes and would say no more. Theero kissed her fingernails. He kissed the V between her thumb and forefinger. He sucked on it as if it were a lemon rind. She slipped backward to allow him greater purchase. A while later, he said, "But Elfi Fabula Fay, are you really not worried about your father and Nessa Rose and little Himihu?" "My father chases hopeless causes. It gives his failure at life some legitimacy. For a while he proclaimed himself a prophet of the return of the last lost tadpole of the Ozma line. That's over now. And my brother Shell, he is probably 15 by now. Look, Theero, how can I be worried about them and be worried about the campaign of the season, too? I can't course around Oz on that broomstick there like a storybook witch. I've chosen to go underground so that I can't worry. Besides, I know what will happen to Nessa Rose at least, sooner or later."
"What?"
"When my great-grandfather finally pops off, she'll be the next eminent Throp."
"You're in line, I thought. Aren't you older?"
"I'm gone, dearie. I'm magicked away in a puff of smoke. Forget it. And you know, that'll be good for Nessa Rose. She'll be a sort of local queen out there in Nest Hardings."
"She apparently did a course in sorcery, did you know, in Shiz?"
"No, I didn't. Well, bully for her. If she ever comes down off that plinth, the one that has words written on it along the edges in gold, reading Most Superior in Moral Rectitude, if she ever allows herself to be the bitch she really is, she'll be the bitch of the East. Nanny and the devoted staff at Colwyn Grounds will prop her up."
"I thought you were fond of her."
"Don't you know affection when you see it?" scoffed Elphaba. "I love Nessie. She's a pain in the neck. She's intolerably righteous. She's a nasty piece of work. I'm devoted to her."
"She'll be the eminent Throp."
"Better she than I," said Elphaba dryly. "For one thing, she has great taste in shoes." One evening through the skylight, the full moon fell heavily on Elphaba sleeping. Theero had awakened and gone to take a leak into the chamber pot. Malky was stalking mice on the stairs. Coming back, Theero looked at the form of his lover, more pearly than green tonight. He had brought her a traditional vincus-fringed silk scarf, roses on a black background, and he had tied it around her waist, and from then on it was a costume for love-making. Tonight, in sleeping, she had nudged it up, and he admired the curve of her flank, the tender fragility of her knee, the bony ankle. There was a smell of perfume still in the air, and the resiny animal smell, and the smell of the mystical sea, and the sweet cloaking smell of hair, all riled up by sex. He sat by the side of the bed and looked at her. Her pubic hair grew almost more purple than black in small spangled curls, a different pattern than Sarima's. There was an odd shadow near the groin. For a sleepy moment he wondered if some of his blue diamonds had, in the heat of sex, been steamed onto her own skin. Or was it a scar? but she woke up just then, and in the moonlight covered herself with a blanket. She smiled at him drowsily and called him Yiro, my hero, and that melted his heart. She could get so angry, though. I wouldn't be surprised if the pork roll you're devouring in such perfect mindless affluence is cut from a pig, she snapped at him once.
Just because you've already eaten, you don't need to ruin my appetite, he protested mildly. Free-living animals were not much in evidence in his home territory, and the few sentient creatures he'd known at Shiz had, except at the philosophy club that night, made little impression. The plight of the animals had not much touched him.
This is why you shouldn't fall in love. It blinds you. Love is wicked distraction.
Now you have put me off my lunch.
He fed the rest of the pork roll to Malky.
What in the world do you know about wickedness? You're a bit player in this network of renegades, aren't you? You're a novice.
I know this. The wickedness of men is that their power breeds stupidity and blindness, she said.
And of women?
Women are weaker, but their weakness is full of cunning and an equally rigid moral certainty. Since their arena is smaller, their capacity for real damage is less alarming. Though being more intimate, they are the more treacherous.
And my capacity for evil, said Fiyero, feeling implicated and uncomfortable. And yours?
Fiyero's capacity for evil is in believing too strenuously in a capacity for good.
And yours?
Mine is thinking in epigrams.
You let yourself off lightly, he said, suddenly a little annoyed. Is that what you're engaged by your secret network to do, generate witty epigrams?
Oh, there's big doings afoot, she said uncharacteristically. I won't be at the center of it, but I'll be on the fringes helping out, believe me.
What are you talking about? A coup?
Never you mind, and you'll stay blameless, just as you want to be.
This was nastiness on her part.
An assassination? And so what if you do kill some general butcher? What does that make you, a saint? A saint of the revolution? Or a martyr if you're killed in the campaign?
She wouldn't answer.
She shook her narrow head in irritation, then flung the rosy shawl across the room, as if it infuriated her.
What if some innocent bystander is killed as you aim for General Pig Butcher?
I don't know or care much about martyrs, she said. All that smacks of a higher plan, a cosmology, something I don't believe in. If we can't comprehend the plan at hand, how could a higher plan make any more sense? But were I to believe in martyrdom, I suppose I'd say you can only be a martyr if you know what you are dying for and choose it.
Ah, so then there are innocent victims in this trade, those who don't choose to die but are in the line of fire.
There are, there will be, accidents, I guess.
Can there be grief, regret, in your exalted circle? Is there any such thing as a mistake? Is there a concept of tragedy?
Fiyero, you disaffected fool, the tragedy is all around us. Worrying about anything smaller is a distraction. Any casualty of the struggle is their fault, not ours. We don't embrace violence, but we don't deny its existence. How can we deny it when its effects are all around us? That kind of denial is a sin, if anything is.
Ah, now I've heard the word I never expected to hear you say.
Denial? Sin?
No, we.
I don't know why.
The lone dissenter at Craige Hall turns institutional, a company gal, a team player, our former Miss Queen of Solitaire? You misunderstand. There is a campaign, but no agents. There is a game, but no players. I have no colleagues. I have no self. I never did, in fact, but that's beside the point. I am just a muscular twitch in the larger organism. Ha! You, the most individual, the most separate, the most real. Like everyone else, you refer to my looks, and you make fun of them. I adore your looks, and I acknowledge them, Fay. They parted that day without speaking, and he spent the evening at the betting parlor losing money. The next time he saw her, he brought 3 green candles and 3 gold candles and decorated her flat for Lurleenmas. "I don't believe in religious feast days," she said, but relented to admit. "They are pretty, though." "You have no soul," he teased her. "You're right," she answered soberly. "I didn't think it showed." "You're only playing word games now." "No," she said. "What proof have I of a soul?" "How can you have a conscience if you don't have a soul?" he asked, despite himself. He wanted to keep things light, to get back onto a better footing after their last episode of moral wrestling and estrangement. "How can a bird feed its young if it has no consciousness of before and after? A conscience, Hero, my hero, is only consciousness in another dimension, the dimension of time. What you call conscience, I prefer to call instinct. Birds feed their young without understanding why, without weeping about how all that is born must die, sob, sob. I do my work with a similar motivation, the movement in the gut toward food, fairness, and safety. I am a pack animal wheeling with the herd, that's all. I'm a forgettable leaf on a tree." "Since your work is terrorism, that's the most extreme argument for crime I've ever heard. You're eschewing all personal responsibility. It's as bad as those who sacrifice their personal will into the gloomy morasses of the unknowable will of some unnameable god. If you suppress the idea of personhood, then you suppress the notion of individual culpability." "What is worse, Firo? Suppressing the idea of personhood, or suppressing, through torture and incarceration and starvation, real living persons? Look, would you worry about saving one precious sentimental portrait in a museum of fine arts, when the city around you is on fire and real people are burning to death? Keep some proportion in all this." "But even some innocent bystander, say an annoying society dame, is a real person, not a portrait. Your metaphor is distracting and belittling. It's a blind excuse for crime." "A society dame has chosen to parade herself as a living portrait. She must be treated as such. It's her due. That denial of it, that's your evil, to go back to the other day. I say you save the innocent bystander if you can, even if she's a society dame, or he's a captain of industry, thriving mightily on all these repressive moves. But not at the expense of other realer people. And if you can't save them, you can't. Everything costs." "I don't believe in this concept of real or realer people." "You don't?" She smiled, not nicely. "When I do disappear again, dearie, I'll surely be less real than I am now." She made to simulate sex against him. He turned his head, surprised at the vigor of his aversion. Later that night, when they had made up, she suffered a racking paroxysm and painful sweats. She would not let him touch her. "You should go away.
I'm not worthy of you, she moaned. And some time later, when she was calmer, she murmured before sleeping again, I love you so much, Fiero. You just don't understand. Being born with a talent or an inclination for goodness is the aberration. She was right. He didn't understand. He wiped her brow with a dry towel and kept close to her. There was frost on the skylight, and they slept beneath their winter coats to keep warm. One brisk afternoon, he sent off a propitiatory package of bright wooden toys for the children and a jeweled torque for Sarima. The pack train was going around the Great Kells via the northern route. It wouldn't deliver Lurlinma's presents to Kiamo Ko until well into the spring, but he could pretend to have sent them earlier. If the snows held off, he would be home by then, restless and chafing in the tall, narrow rooms of the mountain stronghold. But maybe he would get the credit for thoughtfulness. And perhaps deserved. Why not? To be sure, Sarima would be in her winter doldrums, as distinct from her spring moods, her summer ennui, and her congenital autumn condition. A torque, eventually, would cheer her up, at least a little. He stopped for a coffee and a café in a neighborhood just enough off the beaten track to be both bohemian and pricey. The management apologized. The winter garden, usually heated with braziers and brazen with expensive forced flowers, had been the site of an explosion the night before.
"The neighborhood is troubled. Who'd have thought it?" said the manager, touching Fiero on the elbow. "Our glorious wizard was to have eradicated civil unrest. Wasn't that the whole point of curfews and containment laws?"
Fiero was not inclined to comment, and the manager took his silence for agreement.
"I've moved a few tables into my private parlor up the stairs. If you don't mind roughing it amidst my family memorabilia," he said, leading the way. "Finding good Munchkinlander help to repair the damage is getting harder, too. The Munchkinlander tick-tock touch, there's nothing like it. But a lot of our friends in the service sector have gone back to their eastern farms, scared of violence against them. Well, so many of them are so small, don't you think they seem to provoke it? They're all cowards."
He interrupted himself to say,
"I can tell you have no Munchkinlander relatives, or I wouldn't comment this way."
"My wife is from Nest Hardings," said Fiero, lying unconvincingly, but the point was made.
"I recommend the cherry chocolate frappe today, fresh and delicious," said the manager, retreating into repentant formality and pulling out a chair at a table near high old windows.
Fiero sat and looked out. One fretted shutter had warped and couldn't fold back against the outer wall as designed, but there was still enough of a view. Roof lines, ornamental chimney pots, the odd high window box stuffed with dark winter pansies, and pigeons swooping and scissoring like lords of the sky. The manager was of that peculiar stock. After so many generations in the Emerald City, it seemed a separate ethnic strand. The paintings of his family showed the bright gimlet hazel eyes, and refined receding hairlines on men and women alike, and plucked into the scalps of children, too, in the fashion of the Emerald City upwardly yearning middle class. At the sight of simpering boys in pink satin with frizzy-headed lapdogs, and girlettes in womanish dark rouge and plunging necklines, revealing their innocent lack of breasts, Fiero felt the sudden longing again for his own cold and distant children. Though bruised by their particular family life, and who wasn't, in his memory, Irgi, Manik, and Noor managed more integrity than these hothouse scions of a family on the make.
But that was cruel, and he was responding to artistic convention, not to the actual children. He turned his gaze out the window when the order came, to avoid hideous art, to avoid the other people in the salon. Having coffee in the winter garden below usually provided a view of vine-covered brick walls, shrubs, and the occasional marble statue of some improbably beautiful and vulnerably naked stripling. However, from a flight up, one could see over the wall into an interior mews area. One part was a stables, another a neighborhood toilet, apparently, and just within the range of his vision was the wall broken by the explosion. Some sort of twisted, thorny wire netting had been erected across the opening, which led into a schoolyard. As he watched, one of the doors of the adjacent school was pushed open, and a small crowd emerged, shaking and stretching into the sunlight. There seemed to be, Fiero peered, a couple of elderly quaddling women and some adolescent male quaddlings, straplings with early mustaches making a bluish-colored shadow against their fine rose-rust skin. 5, 6, 7 quaddlings, and a couple of stout men who might have been part Gilliconese. It was hard to tell. And a family of bears. No, bears. Smallish, red bears, a mother and father and a toddler. The little bear went unerringly to some balls and hoops under the stairs. The quaddlings made a circle and began to sing and dance. The old ones, with arthritic steps, joined their hands with the teenagers and moved in a Widdershins pattern in and out, as if making a clock face that reversed the clockwise movement of time. The stocky Gilliconese men shared a cigarette and gazed out the wiry barrier across the break in the wall. The red bears were more dispirited. The male sat on the wooden edge of the sandlot, rubbing his eyes and combing the fur below his chin. The female moved back and forth, kicking at the ball just often enough to keep the cub occupied, then stroking the bowed head of her mate. Fiero sipped his drink and inched forward. If there were, 12 prisoners, and only a wire fence between them and freedom, why didn't they rush it? Why were they separated into their racial and species groups? After 10 minutes, the doors opened again, and a gale forcer came out, trim and, yes, Fiero had to admit it at last, terrifying. Terrifying in the brick-red uniform with the green boots and the emerald cross that quartered the breast of the shirt, one vertical strap from groin to high-starched collar, the other strap from armpit to armpit across the pectorals. He was only a youth whose curly hair was so blonde as to look nearly white in the winter sun. He stood with legs apart on the step of the school's veranda. Though Fiero couldn't hear a thing through the closed window, the soldier apparently gave a command. The bears stiffened, and the cub began to wail and clutch the ball to itself. The Gilliconese men came and stood quiescently ready. The quaddlings ignored the order and kept on with their dance. They swung their hips, and they held their arms at shoulder height, moving their hands in a semaphoric message, though what it meant Fiero could only guess. He had never seen a quaddling before. The gale forcer raised his voice. He had a truncheon in a thong loop at his waist. The cub hid behind the father, and the mother could be seen to growl. "Work together," Fiero found himself thinking, hardly aware he could have such a thought. "Work as a team. There are 12 of you and only one of him. Is it your differences from one another that keep you docile? Or are there relatives inside who will be tortured if you make a break for freedom?" It was all speculation.
Fiyero couldn't tell the dynamics of the situation, but he was riveted. He realized his hand was open, palm up against the glass of the window. Below, because the bears had not stood to join the lineup, the soldier raised his cudgel and it came down on the skull of the cub. Fiyero's body jerked. He spilled his drink, and the cup broke, porcelain shards on the buttery herringbone-laid oak flooring. The manager appeared from behind a green baize door and tutted and twitched the drapes closed, but not before Fiyero had seen one last thing. Recoiling, as if he had never hunted and killed in the thousand-year grasslands, he averted his eyes and they wheeled upward, where he glimpsed the pale blond coins of faces, two or three dozen schoolchildren in the upper windows of the school, staring down with fascination and open mouths at the scene in their playing field. "They have no concern for neighbors who have a business to run, bills to pay, and loved ones to feed," snapped the manager. "You don't need to see those antics as you enjoy your coffee, sir." "The disruption in your winter garden," said Fiyero. "That was someone trying to break down your wall into that yard and get them out alive." "Don't even suggest it," shot the manager in a low voice. "There are more ears in this room than yours and mine. How do I know who was up to what or why? I'm a private citizen, and I mind my own business." Fiyero didn't take a replacement cup of cherry chocolate. There were racking cries from the mother bear, and then a silence in the world outside the heavy damask drapes. "Was it an accident I saw that?" Fiyero wondered, looking at the manager with new eyes. "Or is it just that the world unwraps itself to you again and again, as soon as you are ready to see it anew?" He wanted to tell Elfie what he had seen, but he held back for reasons he couldn't name. In some way, in the balance of their affections, he sensed she needed an identity separate from his. Were he to become a convert to her cause, she might drift away. He did not dare to risk it, but the vision of the battered bear cub haunted him. He held Elfie the tighter, trying to communicate a deeper passion without speaking it. He noticed, too, that when she was agitated, she was the more liberal in her love-making. He began to be able to tell when she was going to say, "Not till next week." She seemed more abandoned, more salacious, perhaps as a cleansing exercise before disappearing for a few days. One morning, as he was stealing some of the cat's milk for his coffee, she rubbed some oil on her skin, wincing with sensitivity, and said over her shoulder of soft green marble, "A fortnight, my dear, my pet, as my father used to say. I need a fortnight of privacy now." He had a sudden pang, a premonition, that she was going to leave him. It was a way for her to get 2 weeks' head start. "No," he said, "that's not on, Feifei. It's not all right. It's too long." "We need it," she expanded. "Not you and I. I mean the other we. Obviously, I can't tell you what we're about, but the last plans for the autumn campaign are falling into place. There's going to be an episode. I can't say more, and I must be available to the network at all times." "A coup?" he said. "An assassination, a bomb, a kidnapping? What? Just the nature of it, not the specifics. What?" "Not only can I not tell you," she said, "I don't even know. I'll be told only my small part, and I'll do it. I only know it's a complicated maneuver with a lot of interlocking pieces." "Are you the dart?" he said. "Are you the knife, the fuse?" She said, though he wasn't convinced, "My dearie, my puppet, I am too green to walk into a public place and do something bad. It's all too expected. Security guards watch me like owls on a mouse. My very presence provokes alarm and heightened vigilance. No, no. The part I'll play will be a handmaiden's part. A little assistance in the shadows.
Don't do it, he said.
You're selfish, she said, and you're a coward. I love you, my sweet, but your protests about this are wrong-headed. You just want to preserve my insignificant life. You don't even have a moral feeling about whether I'm doing right or wrong. Not that I want you to. Not that I care what you think about it. But I only observe your objections are of the weakest sort. Now, this isn't something to be argued. 2 weeks from tonight, come back.
Will the action be completed by then? Who decides?
I don't know what it is yet, and I don't even know who decides, so don't ask me.
Fay. Suddenly he didn't like her code name anymore.
Elphaba. Do you really not know who is pulling the strings that make you move? How do you know you're not being manipulated by the wizard? You are a novice at this, for all your status as a tribal prince, she said. Why shouldn't I know if I was being a pawn of the wizard? I could tell when I was being manipulated by that harridan, Madame Morrible. I learned something about prevarication and straight-talking back at Crage Hall. Give me the credit for having spent some years at this, Fiero.
You can't tell me for sure who is or isn't the boss.
Papa didn't know the name of his unnamed god, she said,
rising and rubbing oil on her stomach and between her legs, but modestly turning her back to him.
It never is the who, is it? It's always the why.
How do you hear? How do they tell you what to do?
Look, you know I can't say.
I know you can.
She turned. Oil my breasts, will you? I'm not that stupidly male, Elphaba.
Yes, you are, she laughed, but lovingly. Come on. It was daylight. The wind roared and even shook the floorboards. The cold sky above the glass was a rare pinkish blue. She dropped her shyness like a nightgown, and in the liquid glare of sunlight on old boards, she held up her hands, as if, in the terror of the upcoming skirmish, she had at last understood that she was beautiful, in her way. The collapse of her reticence frightened him more than anything else. He took some coconut oil and warmed it between his palms, and slid his hands like leathery velvet animals on her small responding breasts. The nipples stood, the color flushed. He was already fully dressed, but recklessly he pressed himself against her mildly resisting form. One hand slid down her back. She arched against him, moaning. But perhaps this time not from need. Still, his hand moved down onto her buttocks, felt between her cheeks, beyond, felt the place one muscle pulled in crookedly, endearingly, felt the very faintest etching of hair beginning its cross-hatch shadows, its swirl toward vortex. He worked his intelligent hand, reading the signs of her resistance.
I have four companions, she said suddenly, wrenching away an emotion soft enough not to disengage but to discourage. Oh, heart, I have four comrades. They don't know who our cell leader is. It's all done in the dark, with a masking spell to shadow the voice and distort the features. If I knew more, the gale force could catch me and torture it out of me, don't you see?
What is your object? He breathed, kissing her, loosening his trousers again, as if this were the first time, his tongue tracing the twisting funnel of her ear.
"Kill the wizard," she answered, looping her legs around him. "I am not the arrowhead. I am not the dart. I am just the shaft, the quiver. She cupped more oil in her hand, and as they slid and fell into